KPFT Car. That's 1-855-573-8227. No matter if it's a car, truck, scooter, farm equipment, just about any kind of vehicle, we can take care of it. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR now or visit kpft.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals it is 8 p.m. Wednesday, and once again, time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, along with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and with the very best team on radio, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Hank Rubicek. And on the boards tonight, we have our engineer and media maven, Tatiana Gago, who will be talking with us a little later in the show. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls and transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely and usually gently right back to the present. We've had our share of veteran storytellers grace our studio over the years. But the team on So What's Your Story is especially jazzed about the role we play as an icon in community radio, reaching out to anyone with a story that needs to be heard. And if there is one thing we've learned from the increased popularity of this program and our flourishing Houston storytelling community, it's that stories need to be heard, just like those we are going to enjoy tonight. And tonight we have a newcomer to the show, and we have a returning storytelling veteran. So it should be fun on both counts. My guests are Callie Apodaca, who is a recent graduate of the University of Houston downtown with a bachelor's degree in communication skills. Well, that should serve her well tonight. She served as the communication and development coordinator at a local nonprofit and the station manager for University of Houston downtown's iRadio. I'm told her many talents include the ability to make the best rice and beans you've ever had, though I need this to be proven to me because she did not bring any tonight.
Next time.
We're going to have you back on just so you can bring the beans and rice.
I will.
And she is a fellow animal lover. Any listener to this program knows we are all passionate animal lovers. And she rescued her dog, Xena, 3 years ago. So that actually makes up for you not bringing the rice and beans, the fact that you rescued a dog.
Thank you.
But you still have to bring them next time.
Yes.
Brendan Baroque-Shell is a returning and extremely popular guest who is both a playwright and a storyteller. That is a good combination. His plays have been produced here in Houston by Stages Repertory Theater, the Landing Theater Company, where Brendan is a literary associate. He can tell us more about what that means in a little bit. He's also been produced in Chicago at Death and Pretzels Theater Company. I also want to know the name of that, the story behind that. He's a frequent contributor to Houston's monthly live storytelling show, Grown Up Storytime. When he's not writing, he teaches for the Alley Theater's Department of Education and for the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. Welcome to the show, guys. We are so glad to have you here tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Now, Callie, let's begin with you. You recently graduated from University of Houston downtown. Last fall, was it?
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
And you were the station manager for the iRadio station there. Tell us about your role. What did that entail, being a station manager?
So being the station manager at iRadio kind of entails a little bit of everything. So I like to say that I cover the business side. And the daily operations, and I help with content as well. So I'm kind of a jack of all trades, to tell you the truth. But I love it. It's been an amazing amazing experience?
Well, I've been fortunate to have a few roles at this station, and the more pieces of the puzzle you understand, I think the more addictive and fascinating radio becomes, whether it's the business end, the talent end, the music, the talk. I mean, once you see the whole picture, I don't know, and especially when it's 24/7, you know.
Oh, sure.
You know, and sure, you can drop into the station. There's always something interesting going on.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
What's one of the biggest challenges programmers face when building a program and a loyal listenership, in your view?
I would say right now, one of iRadio's biggest challenges is we are trying to develop goals and metrics that will help us grow in the future. So thinking future-oriented, goal-oriented, thinking big picture.
That's certainly the same for this station.
Yeah. So that's one of our challenges, but it's a great challenge, you know.
Yeah, it is. But it really is not enough to be focused on what you're doing now in the radio game. You got to be aware of what you need to be doing, you know, 6 months, a year down the road, and what's coming around the pike.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially since, you know, everyone's declared that radio is dead for about the last 20 years.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
Well, your story is about the path hundreds of millions of people have traveled. Yet it occurred to me that not a single one of those people had one tiny bit of control over choosing that path.
That's right.
That's an interesting insight. I like that you made that
Thank you.
Observation.
Well, tell us your story, please.
Right. So first, let me ask you and Brendan here. Mm-hmm. Are either of you the first child?
Yes, only child.
First and only. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
That's a shrink field day right there. And I am not. I am lucky to have a wise older sister who paved the way of life for me.
Okay.
She had 4 years life experience to pass on to me.
So I'm talking to your sister, and Tatiana over here is also a first child. So
all right,
these are my people.
All right.
And so I'm the first child. And so, yes, first children are my people. I feel like we all have a understanding between us. It's kind of like we were the first to brave these uncharted waters of life and our family and everything, right? For me, being the first child was a little bit of a curse and a little bit of a blessing at the same time. So to give you a little bit of family background, my mother is born in Colombia. She immigrated here when she was about five to the U.S. My father is Mexican-American, born in Texas, so he's Tejano. And the dynamic in my family is we are very much an American family. So we're very modern American, middle class family. But we do have this, foundation of traditional Latin culture. And so those are very strong. It's a strong foundation, strong pillars that, those elements are kind of, mixed in my family. And so for me, being the first child was a little bit difficult because it held so many contradictions. And by that I mean, on the one hand, I was seen as this very responsible family member who was capable and able to contribute substantially to the family. You know, but on the other hand, I was kind of treated with with kid gloves almost, right? You know, everything was scary. I couldn't do anything that, you know, I wanted to do, right? So it was this contradiction. So, for example, I feel like for first children, the responsibility of someone else's life, having that responsibility in your hands, is a weight that the first child feels much earlier and much greater than the siblings that come after them. So for example, my brother, I remember, and I will never forget distinctly, two times that I've saved my brother's life. One time, he was about 3. He was a toddler. And so that would put me at about, I'm 3 years older than my younger brother. So that would put me about 6. He was drowning in a pool and no one was watching. No one saw him. And I jumped in and saved him. The second time, he was a little bit older. I was a little bit older. A bookcase almost fell on top of him. And I ran in and saved him from, you know, this wooden bookcase falling on top of my brother. So those moments, I mean, and to be honest with you, maybe a little a bit of PTSD from them, but those moments impacted me so greatly because it was this realization of, wow, I am responsible for my brother's life. I'm responsible for his life. And it just made such a deep impression on me. Other things like, you know, just contributing to the household. So, you know, I did more chores, kind of just because you're the first child, your parents, automatically just go to you as their right-hand man. You're their right-hand man. So, I kind of grew up taking the brunt of all the chores. If something needed to get done around the house, it's like, okay, ask Callie to do that, you know? And the rules in my adolescence as a teen, they were always a little bit more strict, you know? Everything was scary because for them, they were parents for the first time too. Everything was uncharted territory. And so, you know, when I wanted to go out, do anything, it was very like I couldn't take a breath without them knowing who was there. Who was I breathing on? You know, all of the details. I couldn't, for example, I couldn't stay at any friend's house. I could go and visit for a few hours, but never spend the night. And I would see that other kids were able to do that. And I was like, why can't I? You know, why can't I, you know, why can't I do that? Why can't I stay at my friend's house, you know? And so it was just, on one end, you feel so capable. You're a contributor to the household. You have these responsibilities of, you know, protecting your younger siblings and really watching over them and being, you know, your brother's keeper. You really know what that means. It's ingrained in you. But on the other hand, your parents are so scared and kind of nervous. You know, it's their first time being a parent too. So it's filled up with contradictions. But I will say that, you know, being the first child has also been an immense blessing. It has taught me humility. No one knows how to push my buttons like my little brother. And he's my best friend. He is the first friend I ever had. And he's my first favorite person. And I love him to death, and I would do anything for him, you know, and I always will. It taught me the value of teamwork and how to work together for a goal. So if we wanted to, I don't know, watch a certain movie or go to Chuck E. Cheese, we knew how to rally together for a similar cause. Right. And it taught me hard work. It taught me responsibility. And I think ultimately, you know, sometimes it was certainly a weight on my shoulders at times, but it has contributed to my work ethic and creating a very strong work ethic. And he's my best friend. So whenever I meet people who are also first children, we kind of exchange this look and we understand. We have a fundamental understanding of each other because we've kind of fought those same battles and paved the way. And it has given me an edge. I think first children are stronger, wiser, and resilient. And I cherish it.
Does your brother agree with that analysis?
I think he would.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe.
And do you think just upon working with you, people would know that you were a first child?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. I'm such a caretaker and such a guider. I like to guide things and ensure that everyone is okay and taken care of.
Now, Brennan, since you were the first and the last child in your family, can you relate to some of this?
You know, when I was a kid, I thought I had gotten off lucky by being an only child. But as I've become an adult and I've seen how siblings are so well adjusted and so good at problem solving, I kind of envy it. I wish that had been the case with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we are fortunate the older we get that you're blessed with the family you're born with. And then as you get older, you get to pick your own.
Right.
Yeah. You know, right. And surround your posse of... you know,
brothers
from other mothers.
That's right.
Now, Brendan Baruchshiel is a talented and clearly a very busy man. Though we only met tonight, I feel a kinship with him due to our shared connection of my alma mater, what most of us graduates refer to as the Ruth Denny High School for the Performing and Visual Arts in Houston. Brendan, when did you realize that you were a storyteller?
When I was a little kid, I lied a lot.
Ha!
And my parents, rather than just calling me a liar, said, "You have a very active imagination," which A, is a very tasteful way to say you're a liar. But B is also a way to encourage storytelling, which is a much more socially acceptable form of lying. So that's where I got started.
Well, you know, I guess I'll interject here that just last week, Dr. Hank hosted the Houston Storytellers Guild Liars Contest.
That's right.
And I do think that most storytellers are probably also very skilled liars when push comes to shove.
Mm. I can vouch for that personally.
I bet your parents can, too. When did the desire to teach others storytelling and writing come into your world?
The desire to teach didn't show up until like a year after I started teaching. I took the job because nobody was offering me jobs. It opened up my eyes to some parts of my own personality I'd been ignoring. I think I never thought of myself as the kind of person who's any good at quickly connecting with people who were very different from me. And when I got that job, that's what I had to do constantly. And I really liked it and I didn't want to stop doing it.
It seems to me that both in your classroom and in your daily life, being involved in your community is a central tenet of your life.
Yeah.
And that sort of shows itself in your first story. Will you share it with us?
Sure. So it was about 2 days after Donald Trump got elected president. I'm sorry to bring it up. But it's important for context because, Greg, you remember what it was like, right?
Yes, I will never forget.
You remember that feeling of motion sickness that happens when the whole world suddenly starts spinning in the opposite direction. And I was walking around my neighborhood, kind of staring at my hand, still holding out for the possibility that this was somehow a dream. And that's when this truck pulled into the parking lot of my apartment complex. It was a rickety, red, beat-up, run-down pickup truck being driven by an equally beat-up, run-down-looking old white guy. There was a Confederate flag on the back.
Whoa.
And the guy driving has a red cut-off t-shirt. He basically looks like the most quintessential Trump supporter. Picture the guy who was in all the rallies chanting, lock her up, that guy. And as I see him, I hear this like growling, guttural voice inside my own mind say, "Get out of my neighborhood." And when I hear that voice, it really freaks me out because it's not something I thought I was capable of. I just looked at this guy and made this kind of instant tribalistic choice to treat him like an invading species. So when I heard the voice, I said, "Dial it down, John Brown. You don't know this guy." "This is a tense moment in American history, but now more than ever, you need to exercise empathy." So I took a deep breath, exhaled my vitriol, and I smiled and waved to him, and he smiled and waved back, and he said, "Hi there, brother." And he got out of his car, and in his arms he was cradling the most adorable corgi puppy I'd ever seen. And I said, "See, Brendan, he's already proving you wrong. He has a dog. That dog has no security or hunting applications. He's clearly not the person who you judged him to be." And so he walks up to me with his corgi puppy, and he says, "I hope you don't mind me asking this, brother, but what's the rent cost here?" So I tell him how much the rent costs, and he says, Now, does that include utilities? I explain how utilities figure in. And then he asks, just as casually, are there other white people here? And I said, come again? And again he asks, are there other white people here aside from you? And when I hear that, I think, Brendan, what is wrong with you? You are so prejudiced against this man that you're somehow mishearing whatever he's asking as, are there other white people here? That's not a question anyone asks in 2016. Nobody is that openly racist in 2016. Now I know what 2017, 2018, and 2019 had in store, so I know better. But anyway, I decide my biased lizard brain is playing tricks on me, and I'm mishearing him. And he's not asking, are there other white people here? He's asking, are the people all right here? So that's the question I decide to answer. I say, yeah, I really like the people here. Families, little kids, pretty quiet most of the time, a lot of cookouts. And he looks at me really confused. And then he leans in real close and he says, no. What I'm asking is, are there other white people here? Because, you know, you do not want to get surrounded. And as he says this, his corgi puppy licks my face. And I'm overcome with the weirdest combination of revulsion and cuteness I've ever experienced. And I still have no idea to this day what I should have said in response to this guy. And part of me thinks I shouldn't have said anything. Part of me thinks I should have just grabbed the corgi and bolted to the nearest library. But what I decided at the time was just to say whatever made him the least likely to move into this neighborhood. Because if he moves in, it's only a matter of time until a couple of his friends do. And then, you know, there goes the neighborhood. So I decide to just tell him the truth. I say, no, I'm the only white guy here. And he looks at me and he kind of laughs and he goes, yeah, I sort of figured. Good luck with that one, buddy. And he pats me on the shoulder and he walks back to his truck. And before he closes the door, he looks back at me and he says, hey, stay strong, brother. And I start to realize when he says brother, I think he means something different than I thought he meant when he called me brother. He closes the door. He drives off the street and back into the American zeitgeist. And that's where he's been ever since. I haven't seen him, but if you out there in Houston see a rickety red pickup truck being driven by a redneck with a Confederate flag and a corgi puppy in the passenger seat, just know the dog is a red herring. And just this once, apparently it's perfectly fine to judge a book by its cover. That's my story.
Wow. And that was the day after the election?
It was 2 days after.
Wow, so it must have felt like the whole world was changing radically.
It felt like some kind of omen, yeah.
I can relate to this story because when I was around 11 or 12, my mother was a newspaper reporter, and she didn't want to interview this guy, but one of her other reporters spent the day with Louis Beam, who was the Grand Dragon the KKK. And it was some trial that was going on, and we had lunch with him and his wife and his beautiful little daughter, who was 3 years old. Mm. And same thing, I was just horrified thinking of how this child was going to be raised, and there was nothing I could do about it. Mm. And it was same thing, he was nice, he was affable, and then the most horrifying things would come out of his mouth.
Right, and you worry about humanizing these people, but you also worry about not humanizing them, and you wonder which is worse.
Yeah, I can identify with that. What's the most important difference you see in communicating in spoken word versus the written form, since you excel at both?
When I'm writing, I feel more free to be verbally dense, to engage in wordplay, to use a lot of complex sentences. And when I'm writing something that's meant to be spoken, I'll be more succinct and more punchy. And of course, the trade-off is you get to layer things in with your voice, your speed, your volume, right, that kind of thing. So,
and I mean, we find that most people, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes, they've got a good attention span, mm-hmm. but you really need to fit it all in that amount of time. And so, yeah, you don't have many words to spare.
For sure.
Now, how did this experience change you long-term after those 2 days?
It was one of a series of things that happened around that time that, to me, put my neighborhood under what I perceived to be some sort of threat. And that's when I started caring more about my neighborhood. Not so long after this Harvey happened, and that was a big flashbulb moment that made me care about my neighborhood, but this was a minor one that preceded that.
Well, you know, my wise sister many years ago had someone move in next door to her. And, you know, she went over to meet them and they said, oh, you know, I'm so glad because we were afraid it was going to be. And then they let loose with a stream of, you know, racial epithets. Mm. And she said, if she, you know, you always think of the perfect thing to say about an hour later. She goes, oh, I wish I had said I was afraid some ignorant redneck was going to move next door. But they did.
Right.
And that's why you become a storyteller, so you can say that perfect thing you thought of an hour later.
Exactly. Sure. Exactly. Right. Well, you know, it's funny you say that because this is a very special week for me, because it was 4 years ago this week that I was driving an Uber car and I picked up a young comedian in town named Connor Clifton, who I didn't know at the time. And he was going to Warehouse Live, to this thing called The Moth. And, you know, I'd heard it on the radio, but I had no idea there was a Houston event. And he told me, you know, that they gave you a theme and you had a month to work on your story. And that the theme that night was delusions. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing I've been told over and over, it's that I'm delusional. So I parked my Uber car, I went in and I put my name in the hat, and thank God they called me first because I didn't have time to get nervous. I didn't even really know exactly what you were supposed to do, but I told my story and I was fortunate to win that evening, and a fantastic young lady named Shannon McKerchy, who was the engineer on this show, and came up to me and said she invited me to be on this amazing program called So What's Your Story with Dr. Hank. And it was just an exciting experience for me. I loved it. He made me feel so comfortable. And he then invited me to be a co-host. And in the last 3.5 years, you know, I've learned so much. Like, you know, you, Callie, you know, I've learned so much from Dr. Hank and learned how to tell stories and be comfortable on the radio. And, you know, I just can't thank him enough and my amazing team on this radio station that's given me this opportunity. I mean, it's been the experience of my life. And I often think, what if I hadn't picked up that fare?
Interesting.
You know, what if I hadn't gone that night? So as I always say to people, if you think you got a story in you, if you listen to us, if you listen to The Moth, and there's a part of you that goes, oh, I have a story I want to tell, please tell it. Get on that stage. Even if you just start out telling your family and friends, that story needs to be told, and you will never regret doing it. I've never met a person who told their story and came out and said, oh, I wish I hadn't said that.
Yeah.
Never, ever, ever have I said that.
Yeah.
Well, my friends, this is Greg Audell, and you're enjoying stories about the many forms of community told beautifully by guest tellers Callie Apodaca and Brendan Baroque-Shell on So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's KPFT. 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Tatiana, are you back there?
Hello, yes.
I know we are the best around, but we are not the only place in town for stories. Would you give us a little rundown on the current Houston Storytelling Report?
Well, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, which is a great place to learn about the art of telling. Thanks to its enthusiastic and supportive members. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. The next monthly swap will be this coming Tuesday, April 23rd. Make that day the day you become a part of our growing community of storytellers. And be sure to visit the Guild's webpage about upcoming events. And while you're there, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio program. There are close to 500 episodes with more than 2,000 stories.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a lot.
That is just incredible. I've already got planned my next hospital visit. Mm-hmm. Next time I'm in the hospital, I'm just going to load in the programs and let them rip.
If you don't own a radio, that's no problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on our Facebook Live. You can visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share with all of your friends. We'd love it if you like us when you leave.
Please like us.
And So What's Your Story is also on YouTube. We are actually really all over the place and recently got back on Instagram, too. Woo-woo. And our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of the month is where you're going to enjoy all of these spectacular stories. Because of spring break, the May Moth will meet on the third Tuesday, which is going to be May 21st, and the theme is going to be Mama Rules. I'm guessing for Mother's Day.
I'm thinking so.
And I promise once you go to the Moth, it will be one of your favorite things to do. And the So What's Your Story team also wants to hear from you and about your program ideas or comments for any one of us. So shoot us an email at story@kpft.org. And I promise we will get back to you.
We really will. And that is a great job, as always, Tatiana. And we're serious. We really do want to hear your program ideas. We really do want to hear your stories. You know, and that's how we're getting so many of our wonderful guests and diverse guests from all throughout the community. Is you got to let us know you're out there. Or maybe you know someone who has a story to tell, and we can call and harass them. Mm-hmm. I'd like to add that on May 14th, I am honored to be the keynote speaker at the annual Lord of the Streets luncheon at the Junior League. Lord of the Streets, known as LOTS, L-O-T-S, is an outreach program of the Episcopal Church to the city's homeless community. If you'd like to attend or learn more about this inspiring group, log on to lotshouston.org. And I would love it if we see you at the luncheon. It's going to be a good time. Next week, my co-host Warren Holloman will be our host with guest Kim Tobin and Regan Elizabeth from Fourth Wall Theater, and Jennifer Dean from the AD Players. In addition to Houston being a storytelling mecca, we are also one of the great theater towns in the nation. And I promise you, you'll enjoy learning about these guests and the theaters they work with. This is KPFT 90.1 Pacifica Radio, fueled for peace. Now let's get back to some great stories.
Okay.
Brennan, how do you get inspired to write creative pieces?
I wish I got inspired. Writing is less an inspiration and more of a compulsion for me. It's something I can't stop doing, and it's just kind of how I quiet the cacophony in my head. So that's my answer to your question. I can't not do it.
Well, that kind of reminds me of my favorite quote about writing, which is from Stephen King. Mm. He says, "I'm a writer because I write. If I feel like writing, I write. If I don't feel like writing, I write. If I have writer's block, I write." And I think that's very true. If you're waiting for the inspiration to hit you, you're probably not a writer.
100% agreed. And I love when Stephen King writes about writing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Everything I read, I identify with and learn something from. Your next story is another look at community and the responsibility we have to look out for each other. And mm-hmm. we look forward to hearing it.
This happened about 2 days after this past New Year's. I was in my apartment, and I heard a loud pop and a scream. And being so close to the holiday, I figured, firework accident. Someone just blew their finger off. And then this guy ran past my window shouting, "My girl got shot! My girl got shot! Somebody help! My girl got shot!" And I watched all the kids who live in my apartment complex follow him back to the parking lot where this apparent shooting happened. The kids are always outside. The older ones are working under a car they've been rebuilding for a couple years. The younger ones are huddled around a PSP game system. And by the time I get downstairs, the kids have already been to the scene and back a couple of times. And they're telling their parents about it, but they're telling their parents about it in Spanish. So I'm out of the loop, and I decide I better just go over there and check it out for myself. So I walk in the direction of the shooting, expecting to see a gunshot victim. Except what I see does not look like a gunshot victim as I understand it. According to movies, a gunshot victim is screaming or catatonic or unconscious, and in any case they're lying down. This one's standing up. She's actually pacing around, and she doesn't look like she's even in extreme pain. She looks just more agitated. She says, and I'm toning her language down for radio, but this is the gist of what she says. She says, "This sucks." Which is a fair thing to say when you've been shot. She's about 20 years old. She's huffing and puffing. She's sniffling. She's hitting the side of a car in frustration. And I'm so confused by the whole scene, I don't even realize at the time it's my car that she's hitting. I don't really know what I'm looking at, and maybe I haven't mentally accepted that someone was shot yet. So I turn back around and I walk back to the kids and I say, can you guys please explain to me what has happened over there? And they're so excited. These 12-year-old kids are so excited to be able to tell me what's happened. They say, okay, so here's what we know. The bullet was a 22. It hit the lower part of her inner leg. There's a gang down the street. They sell drugs, right? And I was like, yeah, because even I knew they sell drugs down the street. But what I didn't know and what the kids tell me now is that they sometimes deal out of our lot. And I'm like, really? I had no idea. And they said, oh, yeah, they're always back there dealing and hooking up. And I'm like, what do you mean by hooking up? And they're like, you know what I mean by hooking up. And I'm like, really? And they're like, why do you think there's a mattress in our parking lot? And suddenly the mattress makes sense. And as I'm having these light bulb realizations about my neighborhood, the fire truck pulls up with a couple police cars in tow. And maybe you would think that time would slow down for something like this, but it turns out it speeds up. The medics, they have the girl who got shot bandaged and in a stretcher in what feels like seconds. Definitely not their first gunshot victim. Probably not their first gunshot victim today. And they leave. The cops hang around to take statements, but the only two people who actually saw the shooting have bolted from the scene, and the cops kind of find this funny in a isn't that how it always goes sort of way. Once the victim's clear of the scene, the kids turn to me and they say, hey, you should probably check your car. You're parked right next to where it happened. And that's when I remember, oh, right, she was hitting my car. So I run back to my car and I find her bloody handprint on my right back window. And I find more of her blood on my roof and more of her blood on the ground. And it's collected with rainwater and it's pooled around my right tire in this crimson puddle. And I think, wait, what if a bullet went into the engine? What if I can't start the car? So I get in the car to check. But before I put the key in the ignition, I think, this is a crime scene. If I start this car, I am interfering with a crime scene. So I look around. I see there's one cop left on the scene. As he's pulling away, I run up to his vehicle and I say, excuse me, sir, there's a good amount of blood on my car, just so you know. He stops. He gets out. He radios the cops who just left to come back. They all start walking towards my car and I think, okay, here we go. Wheels of justice in motion. They're going to take pictures with special cameras. They're going to swab my car's blood. They're going to check it out with a blood spatter analyst, maybe get some criminal profilers in here to read the ballistics report, maybe read the ballistics report and say something like, oh, the way he's shooting suggests he has an Oedipal complex. And then they're going to scour the criminal database for people with Oedipal complexes. They're going to find this guy if they have to put on a 3-day manhunt. And meanwhile, my car is not going to be drivable until a whole team of people in hazmat suits shows up with a special hose to like wash it down. The cops go over to my car. They pull out their phone. They take one picture with their cell phone. They say, okay, so you're good to go. And they leave. And as they're leaving, I think, but wait, who's going to clean up all this blood? And then I realize, oh, that's my job. There's not a cleanup crew coming. There are no CSIs coming. There's no news truck coming because this story is not going to make the news. This story is a non-story. Even the girl who got shot figured that out before I did. And if I needed any more proof of that, the kids who saw it happen first, they're now back in their original spots. The younger ones huddled around a PSP, probably playing a video game where you shoot people. Side note, listeners, if you ever need to clean blood off your car, I recommend Pledge multi-surface wipes. They got the job done real fast. I wiped it off, threw the wipes in the dumpster. It was like the whole thing never happened, except now when I hear a pop in my neighborhood, I can't just pretend it's a car backfiring or a firework. The lie I used to tell myself doesn't work anymore. Every pop is a story, and every story is another non-story.
Wow, Brendan, there's a lot in that story. That's one of those I'm going to be pondering for a few hours. But friends, if you learn nothing else from this show tonight, I want you to remember how to clean up a crime scene.
Pledge multi-surface wipes, wow. Folks.
Absolutely. And we'll put that tip on our website just in case you need it. Years ago in Austin, I had a next-door neighbor, and they had those magnetic car signs, and that was crime scene cleanup. And I didn't realize that when a crime happens, like you say, CSI doesn't come in and do it, that you kind of have to do it yourself.
It was a weird lesson to learn.
I would imagine it must. I mean, do you remember what you were thinking while cleaning up the blood?
I was thinking, I better tell somebody about this so it doesn't become something that's so casual that I just kind of normalize it. Mm. That's where the idea to actually tell the story came from.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like other stories, yours has a lot of parables within it. What's the lesson in your story you don't want listeners to forget?
Well, I think we established pledge multi-service.
Yes, okay. No. I'm sorry to bury the lead there.
If there's another lesson, I hope this story is a not too taxing reminder of the many stories like it that occur daily that don't get written down and said on the radio.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is most stories.
Yeah.
My other favorite thing about storytelling is it's the oldest form of communication. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think as soon as man was able to speak, he started telling someone else about the great hunt he just had.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the animal was probably just a little bit bigger than it was that got away.
Mm-hmm. It's probably prelingual, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. That's what I love about it. We're doing something that's not really all that different than they were doing thousands of years ago. Now, Callie, your story is a poignant statement about just how delicate and very fragile life can be. Will you share your next story with us?
So high school is a crazy time. I know it was a crazy time for me. It's an intense combination of raging hormones, gossip, drama, sex, drugs, alcohol. All of reality kind of just drops its bomb in high school, and there's just life there. And it's crazy. You know, in high school, one of my pivotal moments was being able to drive, you know, having this newfound sense of freedom. You know, my friends were driving. I was driving occasionally when my parents let me. you know, going out to parties. Parties became a social hub, a social thing. And I loved it. It was fun. Meeting new people was so exciting. So one night, one summer night, a friend of mine invited me to a party of a circle of friends that she was close with. I didn't know anyone at this party. And it was a house party rented. It was an apartment rented by a bunch of high school or early 20 guys. And it was dirty and kind of crappy. It was kind of crappy and disgusting, to be honest with you. But it was a perfect place for a high school party. So we all went. And I, you know, not knowing this circle of friends, you know, I kind of stuck by my friend, and I slowly got introduced to everyone at the party and slowly became more and more comfortable and met new people and started to kind of feel, you know, the party vibe after a few hours. But time kept going by, and I noticed this white girl who had short hair and straight bangs, kind of maybe a little too short, you know, maybe poorly cut. Maybe she cut her own hair is what it looked like. And she was heavier. And the entire time from the moment I walked into the party, she was sitting on the floor, kind of messing with her clothes, looking down. She never got up, and it had been already several hours. And I just kept... my mind kept going back to this girl on the floor. What is she doing on the floor? What is she doing here? And I kept going back and almost like obsessing about it throughout this party. And finally, I went over to her. And I knelt down, got eye level with her. And I reached out and kind of very softly and gently touched her. And I looked her in the eye. And I said, I just want you to know that you are so loved. She immediately turned red from her face to her ears to her chest. Her eyes flooded with confusion and tears. She started raising her voice at me. She asked me, "Why did you say that to me? What made you say that to me? Why would you come over here and say that to me?" She got upset. At this point, I'm backing up. I've gotten up and I've given her some space, given myself some space from her because she's visibly angry. She runs out onto the porch and we've made a scene at this point. So the party has kind of taken notice of all of this. A few of her friends follow her out onto the porch, and I don't go immediately because I feel bad. I feel bad because I've overstepped a boundary. I don't know her, so why would I go up to her and make such an intimate gesture? You know, why would I do that? I stepped over some boundaries and I offended her. And so I didn't go out on the porch because I felt like she needed that time with people that she knew. But eventually no one came out. And so it was bothering me now because I felt like I offended someone. I went out there very timidly and I said, "Hey, I just want to apologize if I offended you. I did not mean to offend you, and I am so sorry." And I can see now that she's been crying, and she's again on the floor, sitting on the concrete. And she looks at me angrily and says, "Why would you say that? Why would you say that to me?" And I told her, "You know, honestly, I just felt like something was going on with you. And you hadn't said anything and you were sitting on the floor and I just felt like something was up. And I just felt like that's what you needed to hear at that moment. I don't know why." And she responded to me and opened up and said, "You know, I suffered from depression and I was having thoughts about killing myself. I've tried to kill myself several times before, and being at this party made me feel so invisible. And the fact that no one had talked to me, no one had said anything, made me feel so invisible. I didn't even know why I was here or why I was alive." And, you know, at that point, myself, this girl, and a few of her friends that were out there, we just kind of fell silent. And somehow we started the conversation up again, and we started talking about depression, and we started talking about suicide. And she opened up on her issues with her body image issues. She opened up about a lot of things. And, you know, that night, I look back on it now, and I felt like a lifeguard almost. A lifeguard sits in its post, and it's their responsibility to watch the waters and to pay attention. Most importantly, it's their responsibility to pay attention. And when something seems wrong and something seems off, they have a responsibility to get up out of their post and take action and jump in the water. And they have equipment that they can use to help save someone else's life. They have the floating flotation device. They have that. You know, they have the tools necessary. And I think that in that moment, I don't know if I saved her life that night, right? We'll never really know. And I don't know if I saved her life, but I think I was able to provide a space for her to talk to her friends, her close friends, about what was really going on with her, and that she was facing some very serious struggles with depression and suicidal thoughts. And maybe that's what saved her life.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, I've said many, many times on this show, we all have a little inner voice that I think you need to learn to listen to. And when that voice tells you to reach out to someone, you're risking looking like a fool. You're risking having them yell at you. Mm-hmm. But you're also, by not doing it, you might be risking something far greater by not listening and not reaching out. You know, and friends, you know, if you know anyone that is struggling with suicidal thoughts, just keep the National Suicide Hotline number handy. It's 800-273-8255. And it's a number we should all keep handy, because you just never know when someone's going to come to you with a problem that you can't solve. And that's important. You cannot keep someone from killing themselves, but you can point them to the right resources to get the help they need.
Yeah.
How often do you think about that night and the young woman?
A lot, actually. You know, again, like you said, it's that poignant reminder of listening to that intuition, that voice inside of you. Because I ended up being right, even though I thought I was being crazy and mm-hmm. being weird.
Yeah.
It ended up being a good thing.
People use the term crazy to describe a lot of things we just don't understand.
Right.
You know, and they always have.
Right.
Salem witch trials.
Right, exactly.
What do you want people to take away from this story?
I would say it's the metaphor of the lifeguard, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's such a, it's not easy to jump out into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get distracted from watching the waters and you don't say anything at all when something feels ajar, but that's your job. You know, a lifeguard, they see something ajar, something might be going on, and they act on it. And I just loved that. And I feel like it puts it into an image that is hopefully impacts everyone. And to say that it is your responsibility, you know, it is your responsibility when something looks not right with someone or a situation, do something.
And amen.
I love the lifeguard sentiment, because a lot of us think we just can't help. We're not qualified. We don't have the skills, but we all have some basic human skills that can really help in any situation like this.
And you might be the one. You might be the one that they're waiting on. They don't even know it.
Yeah.
Brendan, do you have any closing thoughts or a closing story for us?
I'll tell a really fast one about a disaster that happened in a production I was involved with recently. So I was working on the show recently. Great cast and crew, except for the playwright, who was kind of incompetent and probably should have been fired. But I'm glad he wasn't, because he was me. And just, for whatever reason, I just kept rewriting this play way past when I should have, which is not good, because if you're an actor working on a play and people keep rewriting it, it's kind of like you're building a sandcastle during high tide and it keeps getting swept away. And I didn't stop rewriting until 13 days before opening night. And I figured it would give these
sounds like me
these actors just barely enough time to get their lines memorized by final dress rehearsal. And I was wrong. They got through final dress. They had never done a complete run of the show off book. And they came up with this contingency plan, this desperate contingency plan, where if they got lost on opening night, one of them would say, "I have to get something in the kitchen." She'd run backstage, check her script, find where they got lost, and get them back on track.
Hey, I gotta go get something out of the kitchen. I'll be right back.
Yeah. So opening night comes. A critic for the Houston Press is there. We start the show, we get 12 pages in, and then it happens. One of my actors answers a line from page 12 with a line from page 34. Yeah.
This
so
is painful.
The other actor, not knowing what to do in the microsecond she has to think about it, answers with the next line from page 34. So now we're on page 34, which means we have just jumped over the middle third of the script. And if we keep going like this, play's going to be over in 15 minutes. And everybody's going to be real confused. So we got to find our way back to page 12. And this is when the actor pulls the emergency parachute and says, I have to get something from the kitchen. She runs backstage. She's gone for maybe 3, maybe 4, maybe 5 days. I'm not sure. The other actor is left to stand out there and twist in the wind. And a minute and a half later, maybe, this actor comes back with a giant grapefruit. Just as big as my head. And she says, see this grapefruit? It's from a tree my dad planted when I was a kid. Anyway, and then she gets right back to page 12. So now, we're back on track. One question remains. What happens when we get to page 34 again? Are they just going to repeat that whole thing? They get to page 34. They don't do that. In this amazing move of on-the-fly editing, they jump clear over the whole thing and just pick up where they left off. The play ends. Everybody leaves. I think we're going to get skewered in the press. It is my fault. I go to sleep. I have a stress dream about it. I wake up the next day. The review is posted. I'm too scared to open it. Then somebody sends me a text and it says, congratulations on the rave. And I'm like, what kind of sick joke is that? Congratulations on the rave. I open it up. The critic calls the play an undeniably compelling character study, brilliantly acted and directed. I have no idea why this critic took away what she took away. If she took pity on us, if the genuine fear that the actors were feeling made for some good performance, or if we actually did an overall good job enough so that they could overlook this random appearance from a giant grapefruit and some eyedrops. I don't know what it was, but I'm glad we got away with murder that night.
But you know, once again, it's clear the community came together to solve a problem.
We did. It's another community one.
Yeah, it is. It is. So I ask you, are you willing to work with this playwright again?
I would be open to the idea.
You would be open to the idea. I guess you'll have a talk with him about preparation?
Yes.
Yeah, I understand. Well, I want to thank my guests, Callie Apodaca and Brendan Baroque-Scheel, for spending this hour with us. It's been a really wonderful hour. And I want to wish happy Easter to our Christian friends and a very happy Passover to our Jewish friends. And I would also like to give a special shout out to my favorite 7-year-old prankster in the world, Mr. Jack Hero Brooks, who I believe is listening. And I will be watching out for your next prank. We will close this program about community with music from Mr. Rogers' Won't You Be My Neighbor. Now, don't you dare move, because tonight, Lars is going to be doing the best Hank Rubicek impression that you have ever heard. Lars was not able to make the program tonight, but he will absolutely be here with the Tennyson tapes next week. So we're going to have a little fun with his next hour, and I hope you'll join us. And in a little while, Hank's going to be in here in just a minute. And to play some sets, and a little while later we're going to be playing the classic Alice's Restaurant. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
Where freedom rings and singers sing. Where Robert Earl Keane meets Martin Luther King. From jazz, justice, peace and rap. R&B, sports, blues and comedy. From heavy metal standing hand in hand with our chants. We shall not be silenced by fear mongers and sycophants.